Hello everyone, welcome to the International Business Podcast. If you work across time zones, borders and cultures, this is the show for you. I'm Leonardo, founder and host of the show, but let's make it simple and just call me Leo. I'm based in Shanghai and I'm accompanied by two co-hosts, Stefano, based in Paris, and Audrey from San Francisco. Coming up on today's episode.
About 4 years ago, we started kicking things off, winning some clients in Hong Kong, some in Singapore as well. And things were all going very well until the pandemic hit, beginning of 2020. So you'd hear words like, oh, it's best practice to do X, or generally we would do it this way. And you'd think, well, is that the right way? Is there another way to do it? Is it like, can you actually compare the one way versus another?
Adrian is a digital entrepreneur. He worked for 10 years in software sales and marketing for companies like Oracle and GE before deciding to start his own business. You can find more details about the guest in the show notes. Now enjoy this episode led by co-host Stefano.
Hello, Adrian. I'm very glad to have you on and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Stefano.
First question we always ask our guest. Why would you define yourself as an international professional?
That's a good question. I mean, to be honest, I don't consider myself to be an international professional in many respects. But then when I think back into my childhood and university time, I spent a lot of time traveling overseas. And I guess I'd always enjoyed the interaction of working with people from overseas. I worked in America for a couple of years after university, traveled to Japan, where I ended up being a radio announcer for a year or so, and traveling through other countries, and absolutely loved the experience and always vowed that at some point during my life, I would go back and doing more international business, hopefully finding some sort of reason to continue to travel to different countries. And it took a while for me to get there, but it was always sort of at the back of my mind when I started my own company that if there was some way that I could branch out internationally and just enjoy that experience, that would be just the coolest thing. So I've sort of ended up living my dream in many respects. I just, while I don't consider myself to be an international professional per se, much of my work is around creating those relationships overseas and bringing value to people in different parts of the world, and that's fun and it's profitable as well, so that's all good.
So we can say that maybe somehow the international part of the business just came to you, just sort of, not, I wouldn't say happened.
But it does, it's almost one of the, yeah, I mean, it's like one of those things that if you want something enough and you keep telling people that you want it, then eventually it starts to come back to you. I didn't actively seek it, but the more I wanted it, the more the opportunity just sort of fell into place. So when finally it did appear, I just thought, this is it. We're gonna do it.
This is very interesting what you say, because I now remember a quote that in one of your recent posts, I think, the greatest law in the business universe is the law of unintended consequences. Is that what you're kind of trying to tell us here with this sort of...
It is. Yeah, I mean, obviously, a lot of what I do in my company at the moment, we do digital analytics, so everything's very kind of binary. You know, either somebody bought something or they didn't buy something. We either got a visitor or we didn't get a visitor. It's sort of, everything's very measurable. But when you try to get beneath that and you try to analyze why stuff happens, there's all kinds of random stuff that happens in our world that is very difficult to nail. And I often find that when I look back on all the things that have happened since I've been running my company and before, that some of the greatest things were things that were completely unplanned. Or at least I had a plan to do one thing and it turned out in a way that I had absolutely not expected. So an unintended consequence always materializes where you least expect it, and they tend to be the most amazing things because you weren't expecting them. Not everything in the business world can be thought through and planned to the nth degree, and you execute on it and it turns out exactly the way you expected it. And if it did, business would be kind of boring, to be honest with you. It wouldn't be a lot of fun. But I look back on all the great relationships I've had with different people, throughout the years, throughout the last 15 years of running Mezzo Labs. And very often I go back to like, well, how did I meet that person? And it was just a chance meeting. I would have gone to a networking event or something and bumped into them and started talking, and one thing leads to another, and they say, oh, you should meet so-and-so. And, you know, it's just these sort of random connections take place. And the next thing you know, you've got you're involved in a fantastic opportunity to do something that you'd never really thought about. My problem is this happens so often that at some point you've got to say, oh, no, we can't do all of these things. We have to go back and focus on something. But it's great to be, you know, in an environment where there's more stuff happening than you can cope with. And then you can sort of pick and choose the best out of it. But in almost everything I do in business, there's a planned consequence, what we expect to happen. And there are some fantastic unexpected consequences that come out. And we need to lean into some of those things and say, you know, maybe what we planned to do didn't turn out the way we wanted, but look at all these other things that we've got. They're fantastic.
And if we apply this to your, I would say, field of expertise, let's say technology, even if we try to apply this sort of law that you just told us, what would you see technology going in 5 years? How can it change in the next 5 years?
Well, by its nature, it's very unpredictable. I mean, it's like when Steve Jobs produced the iPhone, he had no idea that the real reason that people would be buying it in 5 or 10 years' time was not because they wanted a mobile telephony device. It was because of the apps that you could buy through App Store. So there was an unintended consequence of producing the iPhone, was that it would be a great platform for basically the future of, well, the future of everything we know, mobile commerce that we know today. It just came out of that. So looking forward from here into 5 years, it's difficult to know what the unexpected outcome of today's technology would be. There are some things I would say absolutely are going to happen. There's going to be a much greater use of AI, artificial intelligence, in everything we do. Most of it you won't even notice. It'll just be there. It'll just be under the covers. But it'll be controlling the cars that we drive. It'll be controlling the planes in the sky. It's already doing it to a certain extent, but it will be doing it more so. It'll be making the world a much safer place, because the decisions that you could teach a piece of AI to make are far, far safer and less random and less prone to error than we humans are capable of doing. And I think as a result of that, humans will spend more of their time doing stuff that they're good at doing, and making predictable decisions is probably not great use of their time. So I think there's definitely going to be more use of AI. And I think another obvious one is the electrification of many different things that are fossil fuel based at the moment. And my prediction for the next 5 years is that not only will we all be driving electric cars, they will obviously be cheaper than petrol and diesel cars, but also their range, well, I reckon, will far exceed what we can do with petrol and diesel cars at the moment. We just haven't applied the laws of economics and manufacturing to things on scale yet, to the degree where that can happen. But it's almost certainly going to happen, that all the people complaining about the cost and the lack of range in electric vehicles right now will not be saying that in 5 years' time.
It's like 5 years' time is like a, I don't know, million time gap in technology terms. Like it's one light year.
Exactly. And it's just about to accelerate, I think, beyond what we could possibly imagine. And obviously the rising cost of fuel is going to play into that as well. So it's just going to become more and more attractive for people to buy electric vehicles as a new form of transport.
Let's go back one sec. You started your own business on your kitchen table in Southeast London around 15 years ago, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
And recently you chose to expand in the Asian market. And now first question that pops into mind is that the timing maybe wasn't the best one with the pandemic and all.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really bad timing, but you know. Well, I mean, I think it was, just wind the clock back 5 years ago, HSBC were our client in London, and they suggested that we go out with them to Hong Kong to help with a project that was being run out there. And I went out to Hong Kong for the first time since I was a teenager, really. So it had changed considerably. And as I don't know if you know Hong Kong, but when you arrive on Hong Kong Island in Central Station, you get off the train. And there's a shuttle bus that can take you from the from Central Station to Causeway Bay, where most of the hotels are. And I got on this bus, and it was Chinese New Year, and all of the buildings in Hong Kong were lit up like I've never seen before. Like, I've lived in Tokyo and that's pretty amazing. But Hong Kong buildings are much higher and much more brightly lit. And I was looking out the windows of the bus as we're driving up the road, and I was thinking, oh my goodness, I'm in Blade Runner. And this is another world to me. This is amazing. And my mind was completely blown. And I thought, I've got to do something about this. I've got to set up an office here in Hong Kong. So when HSBC said to me, it would be really good if you could actually establish a Hong Kong business, I could see with one customer already, you know, and a very high status customer in Hong Kong, it would be a sensible thing for me to do. And we managed to find a guy to become Patrick, who was managing director in Hong Kong. And he started building the business about 4 years ago. We started kicking things off, winning some clients in Hong Kong, some in Singapore as well. And things were all going very well until the pandemic hit beginning of 2020. And it's been tough. There's no doubt about it. And the restrictions on Hong Kong are among the most extreme in the world. They still have a 21-day quarantine for anybody traveling into the country. And by that, I mean, you have to be in an isolated hotel for 21 days and not leave the room. So that's pretty much shut down all international travel. And I imagine at some point during this year, they will open up again. But certainly it's not an easy place to trade right now. Singapore's a lot better. And the rest of the Southeast Asian region is sort of coming out of pandemic. So I think the potential is still there, but it's been a challenging couple of years. But we're not alone in that. It's the same for businesses.
No, of course. No, you're in a big boat with a lot of people.
Yes.
And Adrian, again, you worked for 10 years in software sales and marketing for companies like, as you said, like, you know, like Oracle and GE, before deciding to start your own business. And what did it push you? What pushed you to go alone, to go solo?
I didn't really have a choice in the matter. My father ran his own business and I watched him do that. And my grandfather ran his own business. All my uncles run their own businesses. So it was kind of not a question of if I was going to do it. It was when.
Yeah.
So the question I would always get from my dad was, you know, how's work going, Adrian? I said, oh, it's pretty good, Dad. It's okay. He said, so thinking about starting your own business yet? And so that was always sort of there at the back of my mind, was like, okay, I've got to do this sooner or later. And I wanted to do it. I felt that it was going to be a good thing for me if eventually I did it. And I got to my 39th birthday and I thought, if I don't do it before I'm 40, I will never do it. So I've got to do it soon. And I just made the decision. I wasn't happy in my job at the time. And the person I was working for was making a huge amount of money. And not in a particularly nice way. So I felt that I could start a business that could at least support myself and maybe a few other people. I wasn't terribly ambitious with it to start with. I was just happy to do it. But I wanted to do it in a good way. I wanted to build a company I could be proud of. I wanted people to want to work there. That was very important for me, that it became an employer of choice in the sector that I chose to move into. You know, I've got certain... you know, ethical or moral standards that I wouldn't want to compromise, and I wouldn't want to be in charge of a company that behaved in an unethical way. So it was very important to me that we could be successful on our terms and not have to stoop to do things that maybe, you know, other businesses that I wouldn't respect would be doing. So, you know, we're a good company, and that's very important for me.
Well, that's paramount, I think, in the ethical terms of the business with the capital B.
That's right. And I think nowadays, actually, even more so. But then when I started it 15 years ago, I don't think too many people were really talking in those terms. They would have just said, well, you know, there's things you have to do in business and you just have to get on with it. And I thought, well, no, there are some things that are done in business that I do not want to do. Yeah, nowadays, I think, you know, if you do you do stuff that is unethical, I think you'll be absolutely held to account, and quite rightly so, by social media. And even to the extent where, you know, we have to prove our credibility and our standards to our clients. You know, they want to see that they have suppliers that live up to certain standards. And I think that's a really good thing.
This episode is sponsored by International Expansion Explained. Are you looking to expand internationally, but you're not sure where to start? Or you export already, but would like to venture further overseas? Reach out to arrange an International Clarity session and learn more about growth plans at katherinereed.com. That is katherinereed.com.
Focusing on the social media that you just mentioned, what if I say measuring digital success? Why is this important?
When I started Metzler Labs 15 years ago, my first client was Barclays. And it was a really amazing experience. But what I could see was that there were a lot of decisions being taken, and it wasn't just in Barclays. I mean, it was the same in every company. A lot of decisions were being taken based on experience and sometimes people's opinions about stuff. So you'd hear words like, oh, it's best practice to do X, or generally we would do it this way. And you'd think, well, is that the right way? Is there another way to do it? Is it like, can you actually compare the one way versus another? And although there were some fairly basic ways of measuring stuff in those days, it was usually based on what we called hits on servers. And people still refer to the number of visitors you get as a number of hits on a website, even though technically it's not a hit in the old sense. But there were some very basic ways that you could measure traffic through a journey and say, well, this many people landed on your website and this many people bought, and therefore there's a conversion rate from one to the other. And you could start to do some basic comparisons between different sorts of marketing. Well, obviously, things have got a lot more sophisticated in the last 15 years, and you can measure a lot. We've taken a slight backward step with the use of cookies, or rather, a lot of people are not using cookies. So that's really affected what we can measure on websites. But we can definitely shine a light on all the waste that's happening, and we can start to use the metrics to improve the performance so that we're more efficient in our marketing. And we can find different ways of selling products to people, because as I said before, most of their decision making we can't get any kind of handle on. We can see them move through a website, and we can make some guesses as to why they clicked on this and they didn't click on that. We don't actually know what's going on in their head. So there's still a lot that we can use the data for to try and improve the experience and try to make things easier and more efficient in the whole marketing process. So measuring digital success is sort of step one in a journey to eliminate as much waste as we possibly can and make life as simple as it possibly can be for users of websites and mobile apps.
When you say waste, you mean waste time, wasting data, wasting...
Wasting money, mostly. Give you an example. If a page is maybe not broken on a website, but it's not functioning correctly. Let's say someone is filling out their address in the purchase process, and they type in their postcode, their zip code, and for some reason it's not recognized in the database. Well, then they get an error and they can't progress any further. Well, that's a complete waste of all the marketing that's driven the person to that point. And they will probably give up, and they'll probably go buy a competitor's product. So that's horrendously wasteful. There's huge amounts of waste in advertising, because there's always this argument that people will see the ad, it creates awareness, but they don't necessarily click through on it, or maybe they'll visit the site a little bit later on, but if it wasn't for the ad in the first place, then they wouldn't even have been aware that you existed. So there's a very strong argument for advertising in a general awareness sense, but there's a lot of advertising which is clearly put in front of people that have no intention of buying whatsoever. So it's put in front of the wrong audiences. But it's very difficult to work out whether that we should continue to advertise to those audiences, because at some point they might buy, or whether that's a complete waste of money. So there's a lot of money being spent on advertising that it's very difficult to measure the effect of.
Looking at the digital experience, do you reckon that the last 2-3 years with the pandemic have been a turning point somehow on how the customer journey that, as you said, changed somehow throughout the pandemic, or what is going maybe to stay after the pandemic?
If you were to compare a website before and after the pandemic, I don't think you'd notice a lot of changes, not on the surface. So you still buy car insurance in exactly the same way. You still do your grocery shopping from Tesco.com in exactly the same way. There are some finer points underneath about things made slightly easier. Maybe a few products are being suggested to you now that wouldn't have been done a few years ago. But actually what's changed before and after pandemic, I think, is two things. One is the demographics have shifted. My parents are 80 and they've now have online shopping accounts with Sainsbury's.com. They had to. They could. There was no other way during lockdown of them getting their groceries apart from going online and putting an order in and hoping that Sainsbury's had what they've ordered and they would deliver it. So they've had to get used to that change of behavior that for digital natives was obvious, that, you know, setting up an account with a supermarket is not a difficult thing for someone that's accustomed to a digital first kind of environment. But for people that are, I mean, my father didn't even have a computer in his business. You know, so in retirement, he got his first PC and he got an iPad and he got all these things. So he's not used to this stuff at all. But there's a generation now that is finally, I wouldn't say they're particularly natural with it, but they accept the fact that in order to buy certain things, you have to buy them online. So there's a demographic shift that's happened there. And the second thing is, I think that there's a digital first has gone mainstream. So If you wanted to buy some paper clips, you wouldn't think, like before the pandemic, you thought, oh, well, the next time I'm in town, I must pop into the stationery shop and I buy some paper clips. Now you don't think that at all. You go straight to your phone, you go to Amazon or whatever your vendor of choice is, and you just go paper clips, add to basket, and you know that tomorrow they'll be delivered. So it's not big items. It's not items where you'd save a lot of money or they were hard to find. This is commonplace items. You go digital first now, and I think that has gone mainstream. I think it would have been younger generation people would have done that before the pandemic, and now after the pandemic, I think that is the way that a lot of people think, is if you need something, you just go online, you just get it.
So somehow this pandemic, ironically, well, not ironically, but naturally, kind of broaden up the audience overall of the digital experience.
Yeah, I think it broke down certain barriers. In many ways, it broke down. Working from home, for example, that was something that most companies were very nervous about letting their employees do before the pandemic. Then it happened and they had to embrace it. Otherwise, they would have had to shut down completely. And for most of us, most sort of office-based jobs, if people already had laptops and they had a reasonable internet access from home, they could carry on pretty much as normal. Not quite the same, but the disruption was far less. So I think the pandemic sort of forced us to get on board with some of these things that have been around for some time, but we the mass market, the main market, didn't need to lean into and didn't need to embrace until the pandemic happened. And now after the pandemic, you think, oh, does it go back to the way it was before? No, it doesn't. No, this is the new normal, as they say.
I've got one final question for you that we ask everyone who comes on the show. And I would like you to tell us about a memorable moment in your international career, or somehow international life, I would say. So the most successful, the most embarrassing one, the most catastrophic, I don't know. I hope it's regarding your time spent in Japan, being a radio broadcaster, but that's a whole another story,
well,
chapter, I think.
Funny you should say that, because there's been some interesting things that have happened while I've been in Hong Kong and Singapore, but I've not spent enough time out there for an amusing story to come out. However, going back to when I was a radio announcer in Japan, I worked for NHK, and NHK is like the Japanese BBC. It's a sort of a nationally run broadcaster, high quality broadcaster. And I somehow managed to get myself a job as a radio announcer because I walked into reception of NHK in Shinjuku, and just walked up to the receptionist and said, "I'm a radio announcer. I read the news. Can you find me a job?" And they're so polite, they actually put the call through to the news department and said, yeah, if you can go up to the 13th floor, a man will meet you there and talk to you. And I walked in to an office and they gave me a script straight. You just thrust a script into my hand and said, there's the newsroom. Go in there. When the red light comes on, read the news. So I read it. And then he said, oh, actually, that was very good. Why don't you come back when you've got all your visa paperwork sorted out and I'll give you a job? Well, a month or two later, I managed to get all the paperwork sorted out. and went back and saw him. And I became a radio announcer on shortwave radio. The catch was that it was at 2 a.m., 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. In the morning. So Ouch. Not an easy shift. It was clearly a shift that nobody else wanted, and I had to do it a couple of days a week. But it allowed me to be an English teacher during the day and a radio announcer on certain nights of the week over nighttime. And I worked out that in between the news readings, I could actually get my head down and get a little bit of sleep and then set my alarm clock and wake up in time for the next news reading. Well, guess what happened one evening? My alarm didn't go off, so I was asleep. And the editor apparently was running around the place shouting, "Alien, alien, where are you, alien?" And eventually I woke up and it's like, why is he shouting for an alien? And I suddenly realized it was the way that he was pronouncing my name, Adrian. And he thought that that was going to wake me up. So unfortunately, I missed a broadcast and had to deeply apologize to the editor of the news team afterwards for being an idiot alien. At the end of the day. So there we go. And that's why I'm not a radio announcer now, I think.
Thank you for that, first of all. And before we go, who should connect with you? And if you can tell us a little bit more about your current role that you didn't say it already, actually.
If I haven't already said it, then I have two companies. I have Mezzo Labs, which is a consultancy that helps major corporates like HSBC and Barclays to analyze the data around their websites and their digital marketing. So it's an analytics consultancy. So anybody that needs help in that world, please connect with me. My other company was a kind of spin out from this. I created a SaaS platform for measuring the effectiveness of campaigns, which I hinted at earlier on in this podcast when I said there's a lot of waste in advertising. Well, this platform, Uplifter, connects adverts to websites so that you can measure more exactly what kind of traffic you're getting, independent of cookies. So if anybody's interested in making sense of the reports they get on what advertising is working and what's not working, then we have something that you're sure to be interested in. That's Uplifter. So please connect with me to find out more.
Adrian, I want to thank you so much for your insight and your experiences. And thank you for joining us on the International Business Podcast.
Thank you very much, Stefano. It's been an absolute pleasure.
You can find the podcast on all the major platforms. Make sure to subscribe, do not miss the weekly episodes. And are you an international professional? Connect with us on LinkedIn to come on the show. For now, cheers.